Okay, it is the 11th of November. It is the cybercrime class. And we're going to hear about a peeping Tom. Tell us.
So there's a guy in Massachusetts that was taking pictures of women's private parts when they were like on a tree, basically off their skirt, kind of seen his wife. And he's claiming that women who do not completely cover up what's beneath or in between their legs, they have no expectation of privacy, and therefore it's a first offense. She's protected by the First Amendment. And this is actually made up to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court.
Which is the highest court in Massachusetts?
I believe so, yeah.
Now, it made it up because he's lost on the lower levels and he keeps trying? Or has he actually succeeded in claiming this?
Well, it says right here, it's one article saying that the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court mulling just whether an alleged absurd right to snap a woman's nether regions is defended by the U.S. Constitution, and indeed whether women who unwittingly expose themselves in public have any right to privacy. I'm not sure if it's at their highest court.
All right. So let's see what we have here.
I heard on the radio, and I was like, oh, we're going to, this is great.
It absolutely is. Now, you know, okay. Apparently Getty Images has that one. I'm just going to leave that. Okay, so here's the original article. Lead subway peeping Mike. Oh boy. Is this current? It is. Okay, so if a clothed person reveals a body part, whether it was intentional or unintentional, he or she cannot expect privacy. All right. Okay, so he's still on trial. What this says is, his trial in municipal court has been stayed pending the appeal before the state's highest court. And here's where we get into the cybercrime stuff. Okay, so we have a peeping Tom, skeezy guy. Mencken, who is the lawyer for this man, she argues, see, if you want an example of someone who believes in the necessity for representation, I would suspect that Ms. Mencken is a prime example of that. Now, I don't know the woman. Perhaps she supports what he's doing personally. However, in a vacuum, a female attorney who takes this case and argues it strenuously believes in the right to representation for everyone. Mencken maintains that the laws regarding taking unwanted pictures of women are outdated and actually protected under the First Amendment. That's a really poorly written sentence. She told the justices that peeping Tom laws protect women and men from being photographed in dressing rooms and bathrooms who are nude or partially nude. However, the way the law is written right now does not protect clothed people in public areas. Okay.
If you don't have an expectation of privacy between your legs, where do you have privacy?
No, but so the opposer, I guess the state attorney, said because of the camera, Robertson, the defendant, saw parts of a woman's undergarments that he otherwise couldn't have seen. Mencken explains things differently. What he saw was in plain sight. He did not place his camera directly up a woman's skirt. He saw what was in front of him. Apparently, he was standing as he used his phone by his waist, directing it toward a woman's private area discreetly. I guess maybe they were seated?
Yes.
Okay. So, sort of, so what's the cybercrime connection? Yes, it's a case that people love to talk about, and I'm sure get wrong. But I think we can, in fact, find some good cybercrime issues there. First of all, is this a cybercrime? Ah, is that what this is about?
No, it's not. But that's, to me, that's where I'm getting stuck.
Okay, so as is anything about this a cybercrime? You would think so.
I'm not sure.
Well, you raised it, right? You brought it up in class. In cybercrime, I see hands, but we're discussing here. Is this a cybercrime? Make the case. Something about it got your attention. Why?
Because he's using his phone.
Ah! So?
So he's taking pictures and storing...
If it were a camera, would it change your mind?
Maybe, but...
Why? What's the difference?
Because most of the... I'm going to assume that the phone is taking pictures like that. It's a smartphone.
So?
So smartphones have access to the internet where cameras may not.
But we... So there's no way of getting a photo off a camera and posting it online?
Well, as it is, I'm saying, like, if he's taking a picture with his cell phone...
Right, but this is, again, case as is. We don't have allegations of uploads. Cybercrime or not cybercrime? Okay, so now we're on the no. Anyone going to say yes, and if so, why? Why?
The collection of the evidence from the phone, depending on whether he consented to them.
Oh!
Taking.
Now that's interesting. Is it a cyber crime? Maybe not. The relevance for here? There might be invested. How did they find out? What did they do? I think that is, and we don't know. But there certainly could be issues because it is... a device, a phone. It's not just a camera. What else?
What's like the general rules on like, let's say taking it, but not like a new, like a regular picture or something without their consent?
Where?
Let's say.
No, I mean, what types of jurisdictions laws will apply in that circumstance?
Okay, let's say I'm just like walking down the street.
No. I'm asking you a question. To where would you look for relevant law, for relevant statute? And which database in Westlaw would you be looking at?
Statutes.
For what?
I guess like privacy laws.
Which privacy laws? Albanian privacy laws?
New York.
Oh, wait. And New York is what? As opposed to Albania or Australia or United States of America. What is New York?
It's a state.
These are state laws. So there isn't a law. There may be at least 50 laws, and there could be local jurisdictions. So your question is not an answerable one in a sort of broad sense.
Okay, so New York State.
Tell us next class. Go look it up.
This actually happened with books.
All right. I have no idea what the answer is, but we have someone whose boss was apparently an upskirt picture victim.
She went to go get a business customer at a network, and the guy was with his phone taking a picture of her cleavage. And she's like, "Are you taking a picture of me? Are you taking a picture of me?" And there was a cop in the parking lot. He said he couldn't do anything.
Right. So, as a general rule, and maybe we will find out what the specific New York statute is. In public, let's put it that way, right? One does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy from photography. Whether it's a business surveillance camera, generally speaking, there may be New York specifics. Business camera, personal camera, snapshots, there are some exceptions. Commercial use. Recognizable faces in commercial use of photos, you need permission. If there's some sort of someone who is famous who might be seen as endorsing a product or service, that might also require. But as a general matter, public sphere, publicly viewable, no, you don't. Certain private spaces, changing areas, locker rooms, etc., there may be a general exception to that, or there may be specific anti-surveillance laws that will apply. What this is getting at, why I think this has the potential for relevance in the cybercrime world, and remember, I think we talked about, maybe we didn't, but the whole idea of a right to privacy is a technology-driven thing. It arose out of candid photography. Brandeis and Warren wrote their article, The Right to Privacy, about candid photography and essentially the 1890s equivalent of tabloid journalism because of technology. So what is being argued here? Is what's being argued here that only that taking upskirt photos is artistic? It's not just that. At least according to this piece, this article, there are a couple of things. One, the defendant's lawyer argues that the statute as written doesn't cover this circumstance. And that is very much a cybercrime-related situation. Look at all the cases and situations that we have read where the statute as written doesn't quite get there. It's wrong, it's offensive, it offends the morals of good people everywhere, but it may not yet be criminal because the statute as written doesn't cover this situation. So, one of the lawyer's arguments is he is being prosecuted under a statute that doesn't cover this. The wording of the statute, whatever statute it is dealing with private locations and not private parts, if you'll pardon the simplification. Megan told the justices, I know you can't read that from there, that peeping Tom laws protect women and men from being photographed in dressing rooms and bathrooms who are nude and partially nude. However, the way the law is written right now does not protect clothed people in public areas. That may be true. If it is in fact true, then this skis bucket, and that's the legal term, this skis bucket will walk unless they can find some other crime with which to charge him. You're shaking your head. You're not happy with that? Why not?
I understand what they're saying is illegal, but I mean,
well, we're not in, you know, moral school. We're in law school. I'm not saying it's the right, it is a good result, but it is the result, right? The same way David LaMacchia, when he posted all that software online, walked because there was no criminal, well, he may have been sued, but he walked out from a criminal because it wasn't wire fraud. It was copyright infringement. The law as written then required that he make a profit. He didn't. He couldn't go. He
could. A ruling like this, my thing is that as a country, it's just our concern to protect them. I'm just going to go by instead of taking that another step.
Again, this is a law school. So, within the structure, what is that next step? We have a couple of choices. We can just, you know, bring up a lynch mob. What else can we do?
Change the law.
He may walk, although if he's really skeezy enough, he'll do it again. Right, statistics show he probably would. Change the law. Just as in these cases, the cases we read for today, the Robert Morris case I want to get to, the law didn't necessarily cover. The judges and the legislators were faced with this issue. It may well be he has found a loophole. He's got a creative lawyer who looked at the statute. It talks about the location. It specifies the location of being a private location. This was a public location. And this statute doesn't apply. And maybe the reason this statute doesn't apply is because the last time the legislature looked at this issue, in order to take a picture, you had to actually pull out a camera. Or something that looked like a camera. And it was kind of obvious that if someone were sitting across from you on a subway holding a camera, there's some weird going on here and you'd move. But people hold their phones. You know, I'm playing a game. I've got my phone right here. Click, click. It would never have occurred to a legislator, a smart, well-meaning, upstanding, moral legislator, to write this in because it could never have happened this way. It just, there wasn't going to be a situation like this. The same way that back when cameras were this big and required 15 seconds or a minute for exposure, you didn't worry as much about cameras in bathroom walls. Because you couldn't put one there. Foomf, you know, big, big flash powder, whatever it was. Technology evolves, the law catches up. Eavesdropping has been redefined. Wiretapping used to require a wire and a tap of that wire. Put another wire on. Listen in. Now, wiretapping doesn't require that. Wiretapping apparently now requires that somewhere in the world there is an office of a telecom company and some government official has found a way, licitly or illicitly, to monitor the data streams. Technology changes. And so the argument that this lawyer is making is technology has changed, the law may not have. I don't have the wording of the statute. We would have to look at how that statute, if it has ever been interpreted, right? It may well be this statute has never come up in a reported case because it's pretty clear on the front. You're not supposed to take a picture of someone in a private No one's ever been arrested for this and charged under this statute. It's possible. The other side to this, of course, is the issue of reasonable expectation of privacy. And we see that over and over again in our cases. Workplaces. Internet service providers. Public Wi-Fi hotspot. We haven't had that one yet. You know that will come up. Do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy for unencrypted communication sent over a public Wi-Fi hotspot? I don't know.
They give you a warning that it's not private.
Who gives you a warning?
When you go into like Starbucks, it says that this is like something, I think your computer does it actually. It's not even like
your computer says, your computer may, depending on how it's configured.
It tells you it's like an open public domain.
Right. And, but what if, you know, but sometimes they aren't. Or sometimes you're just, oh look, there's Wi-Fi. I'm going to hop onto that for a second. You're shaking your head. You've never done that.
Well, you do, but
if you're aware enough to realize there is a risk. Well, then we get back into this issue of is the knowledge, the technical knowledge of the victim relevant here? And we've seen situations of the perp, right? Where the technical knowledge of the defendant turns out, you may have thought it was deleted, but the fact that you're wrong doesn't mean that you're reasonable, you're expecting, you were just inaccurate. You didn't know enough. Sorry, that's not good enough to protect you. These issues. Now, so this was, it seems, a normal camera. But it was a phone, so there's those sorts of interesting questions. What if it weren't a normal camera? Sony a few years ago came out with a line of camcorders. I think it was Sony called Nightshot. You ever hear of those? Sorry? I haven't, but the GoPro, of course, is just, it could be everywhere. So these were videos taken. Now you'll pardon. These were videos taken with the Sony Nightshot, the early versions, which had a nice filter on them, on it, that basically could see through clothing. Okay? I wouldn't presume. If you remember, hey, I remember that scene, I was there, that's another story. What do you do with that? This wasn't an upshot photo, right? Upskirt photo. This was that consumer available technology had an unintended, one would think, an unintended consequence. What's the reasonable expectation of privacy? How do you write a story? What about the GoPro? Now, the GoPro, as I understand it, is a rugged mountable camera that you can put on your helmet or on cars.
Yes.
But what is that? What's the GoPro story now? What's happening with the privacy issues with GoPro is that they're, particularly in places like Russia, drivers are mounting GoPros on or other kinds of mountable video cameras on their cars, dash cams. And so they're capturing all sorts of things. When that meteor hit, slammed into Russia, those pictures were from a dash cam. But car insurance companies are very interested in this. Yep. The quadro, yep.
And they're spying on
people and buildings and stuff. Well, it's not just GoPros. So now we have an entire series. So there too, technology is changing. We've seen some of this in the investigation side. I know this, and I think it is relevant here because this is about, right, all the ways of unauthorized access in a technical sense. But what do you do when the unauthorized access is because what used to require a very loud, very public helicopter now requires a little quadricopter that's about this big, is inaudible over a stiff breeze, and can mount a camera pointing straight down over your backyard because you've got a skeezy neighbor. This isn't an upskirt, this is a downhead. New technologies, new capabilities, new questions. Yeah?
Isn't that like trespassing now? Because like now, when you buy land, you own everything above and below it. And then if you bring a helicopter like, reasonably, like one of those things.
And I'm not going to make you do it again, but where would you go to answer that question?
Okay.
Where? I'm really not going to. So you feel safe to answer this one. Where would you go to answer your own question? Don't say Westlaw again, or I will. What would you look to? Is it trespassing or isn't? How do we know? Yes. Well, how is trespass defined? And is the law about air rights the same body of law as trespass? It isn't. Because otherwise you could be suing every airliner for trespass. Right? Oh, wait. JetBlue. JetBlue. I'm in the JFK approach. JetBlue. LOL. JetBlue. You're assuming. But the law may not. And why would the law ever have considered 100-foot aerial trespass? Why would it have even occurred to a legislator? So the law will, but then you have to define all sorts of things, and they're scrambling to come up with rules about, depends on whom you ask. They are unmanned area vehicles, they are drones, or they're model airplanes. The same thing could be all three. And people have been mounting cameras on model rockets and model airplanes forever. But now, for a couple hundred bucks, you could buy one of those quadricopters with a camera and a wireless signal that you can control from your phone. Doesn't require a hobbyist. Doesn't require, you know, little fuel and teeny little engines. All it requires is a credit card. We can have it tomorrow by Amazon if we order by four and we pay for one-day shipping. I so want one. I want to play with it, but I think it would also be a great example. So we have our skis. And, you know, he's making a First Amendment claim, which I guess is him as artist. Or is he saying that someone is speaking by not wearing underwear? I'm not sure. Yeah.
Regarding that, now, because it's just a camera, I don't know what the issue, but what if it's like, you know how like iPhones are, how they like sync to iCloud? That make it an issue? Like, it's like
back. Well, what would change? You're right. There would be one very important distinction between picture taken and picture saved over the internet. What changes?
Well, it goes to, server.
Yes, it does. From a technical sense, cloud server, whatever. What changes from a legal sense? What would be true of that, even if he didn't share it with anyone, but he backed it up to iCloud or Dropbox or wherever? What?
The crazy case that iCloud would be hacked, I guess.
Before that, what changes? What are we reading? What are we reading? Not the particular case, but what are we reading? What is this week's readings? What were last week's readings about, specifically? What were they? What did we read about this week and last?
This week or last week?
Both. Specifically. We're reading about a particular law, aren't we? What law are we reading about? Yes. And that is what type of law? Yes, it's criminal law. What type of criminal law? Federal criminal law. And why does that suddenly come into it? Why would federal law, and it might not be that federal law, but why might federal law somehow immediately be relevant in the situation you're discussing? What changes? How did that picture get from the phone to iCloud? There's a wire?
No.
How does it get there?
Wireless
how?
Networks.
What network?
The Apple network.
No, it's not the Apple network. It's a little bigger than Apple. It begins with an I. What? What? Yes, you are. It begins with an I. We all use it every day. It was made of tubes and Al Gore invented it. The internet. The internet. Interstate telecommunications network. Because it ends up on the internet, if there is a federal law, there's federal jurisdiction. Without that, we're in the Boston Municipal Court. And we're not looking at federal law, except, of course, federal constitutional issues apply downward. But this is a hugely important question. One, the kind of thing that might end up, oh, I don't know, on a final exam. Look for the federal question. What type of law applies? Or if he emailed this to a friend, boom, federal question. If there is a federal anti-surveillance law, anti-upskirt picture law, it can be invoked once this image is transmitted. Conversely, there are cases where they're prosecuting someone for possessing child pornography on a computer. And the prosecutors are trying to use federal anti-child porn cases. Statutes. Unless the prosecutors can demonstrate, or could demonstrate, there are cases, that these pornographic images were transmitted, received through the internet, they cannot invoke federal child porn laws, only the state equivalents, if there are any. Without that transmission, the interstate part of this, the protected computer in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, unless you have interstate commerce involved, the federal government has no jurisdiction. Now, we're setting aside how broadly interstate commerce has been defined in certain circumstances by certain courts. But is it a state question or a federal question or both? To which law or laws do you look? Look at the facts. In this circumstance, this is a local picture. Yes, perhaps a phone was used instead of a dedicated camera. Although the difference at this point is meaningless. You can get a Samsung Galaxy camera that looks like a camera but also functions as a phone. Or you can get a Samsung Galaxy phone that looks like a phone but functions like a camera, and it's the same camera bits and the same phone bits inside. It's different casing. The device may or may not matter. They're not invoking cyber law here. This is a straightforward state right to privacy question. You have to look at how the statute is written. You have to look at whether, in fact, one would be seen to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in one's clothing while wearing one's clothing. I would imagine the answer will probably be yes for that question. Does the statute, though, address this? That I'm not about to say. So she may, or these victims may, in fact, have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And they may have rights to sue him under state privacy claims. He has infringed their privacy, he has intruded upon their seclusion, whatever the particulars in Massachusetts are. But criminal law requires that there are elements of an offense, all of those elements are present and have been violated, every single last one. And if the particular law relevant to this Massachusetts situation does not, in its four corners, or as it can be reasonably stretched, does not talk about a public place, then he is going to walk on the criminal charges unless they can find something else with which to charge him. Right result, wrong result? Necessary result. Necessary result. So, while the case itself is barely relevant, I think it does raise a lot of really interesting issues. Anyone see the article in the New York Times on Sunday about college admissions officers looking at high school, college applicants, public profiles, and Twitter postings? It's called They Like Your GPA But Not Your Tweets, something like that. Interesting article. What? Yes, I did. In fact, I got back and forth with the New York Times reporter, which is kind of a cool thing. But it occurred to me, it's relevant to here. What is the objection that these students have, other than the fact that they're embarrassed and not getting into school? What's their claim?
Reasonable expectation of privacy that the school isn't going to look at their Twitter or Facebook accounts, even though they're public.
Right. But let's look at 18 U.S.C. 1030. Intentionally accesses a computer without authorization or exceeding authorization, right? Our magic phrase, plus the and. Have the colleges exceeded their authorization? You say no. Why not?
Because it's a public page and anyone can do anything on it. So it's like there's no authorization required.
But does the intention of the poster matter?
Depends how you interpret this statute.
Could the intention of the poster matter?
Yes.
Maybe. I'm not convinced. But you can certainly see that there's a feeling. I didn't authorize them to do it. Well, you didn't have to. And so maybe that's the important thing to bring out of that story, as well as remember everybody's watching you when you're posting online publicly, and even if you don't think it's public, your friends can repost it and you're screwed. So, but maybe that's the important bit of this. The question of from where authorization comes exceeds authorization. Without authorization, authority, permission, granted from whom? Who has the right to grant access? In the case of your Facebook or your Twitter or your Pinterest or your whatever it's going to be, who has the right to grant authorization? The company, right? The service provider. Does the user? Well, the user may withhold authorization or not. Not friend someone, post it only to friends, have a private Twitter account. But as we've seen in some of these cases, that's not going to do it. Because once something has been posted somewhere, many courts will say you have no reasonable expectation of privacy because you cannot physically control what the recipient does with it. And there was a story today in said same New York Times, self-same, said New York Times, about small data, I've heard of big data, but companies that are taking publicly accessible Twitter feeds, etc., and analyzing them like you wouldn't believe, slicing them and dicing them and coming up with all sorts of profiles and information. And so they're taking an entire body and drilling down. They have authorization from Twitter or Facebook. They may not have willing participation from the people, but they chose this medium.
Wasn't there something that the law passed that Facebook and Twitter now, if you're under a certain age, they have to allow you to put certain things from? I remember hearing it on the news maybe like a week or two ago.
It's actually the opposite. It's actually the opposite. Facebook just announced that in a change to its prior practices, it was going to permit those between 13 and 18 to post to the public, not just to their friends. So they were actually opening it up to embarrassment and scorn, ridicule, rejection from college, whatever it is. But this question of authorization becomes a really important one. So let's look at these cases that we have here. Because we went through the statute last week and we did go through these elements, but let's look at how these cases examine these elements. Anyone want to help us with Check versus Wall Street on Demand? You're looking up. Please help us with Check on Wall Street. So where are we? What's the fact pattern here? You're going to have to speak up. So well, let's start with, where is this court case being heard? What kind of court is it? Jurisdiction, all that good stuff.
It's Federal District
Court. Yep, where?
Minnesota.
Okay, good. So we're at the trial level, federal level. Okay. And under what statute is this being brought?
This is going to be under CFAA.
Which is? CFAA stands for? What have we been reading for the last 2 weeks? C stands for?
Computer.
Yep, you're getting there. Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The federal cybercrime statute 18 U.S.C. 1030, CFAA. Go ahead.
So if you were receiving text messages from Wall Street on demand, and she made an information claim saying that they were, I guess, accessing technically her phone.
Okay.
Her information just to send her the text messages. And I know one of her theories was that they were actually taking up space on the hard drive.
Or the right, the memory of her phone.
Yep.
So under what provision, what general offense was she alleging? Which was, at least as...
Potentially accessing the computer.
And, remember, you can't, that's not enough. And?
Information from an executive
computer. So, obtain information. Okay. 1030A2C. So, you have to obtain, so, exceeds authorization or without authorization, accesses a protected computer, and obtains information. So, where are our elements? First of all, is this a federal question? Why is it a federal question? Yes, it is. Why? What makes it a federal question?
Because it was communicated. Yes, it's a text message.
Which uses what? Or the wireless or the telephone network. Either way. Check. Okay. Federal question. It is it a computer?
Phones are computers.
Check. Is it protected computer? Yes, because it's used in interstate commerce. Good. Was it off? Was it accessed?
The report said that. The report said that it wasn't. They said that her claim was.
Right. She doesn't succeed. Well, that wasn't so much. The issue was what, how it was accessed or how it was contacted. So what is her argument about access? What information was received back?
That it was a working
phone. Right.
That it was an operable.
It didn't bounce back. And sometimes you can get a receipt. So she's saying they received information that the number was good. Okay. And how did they receive that? The area code, which of course does not tell you anything about where someone is located. My daughter was on a trip to Israel. We rented her a phone. It had a 516 area code number, so we could call her. It was a local call for us. I love the internet. So here what you have is there is a potential argument that the elements of the statute are present. But as the court goes through them, so is it a protected computer? Arguably, it has computing functions. Was it accessed? Maybe, maybe not. It's not even what we've seen in the past about the login screen. There was no return information. There's nothing that the phone was generating and giving back. Did this message end up in the storage? Yes. But is that access or is it just delivery? Was it without authorization? Yeah, probably. Or because she didn't sign up or exceeding authorization. But did they obtain any information back? While any one of these, arguably, at least most of them, could be found, what we see in this case, not quite there, not quite there, not quite there, not quite. It doesn't add up to a cognizable claim under this statute. Even if it could maybe be stretched, the court's not willing to stretch it. It's understandable why. This is clearly not remotely the situation that the drafters intended. I should point out, and will, that this is not the only statute relevant to this particular situation. Because it is illegal to send an unsolicited commercial text message to a cell phone. It's illegal. It is the, I think it's the Telephone Fraud Act. I'm going to get that wrong. But it is a federal statute that is an anti-commercial text message statute. It is enforced by the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission. It requires, if you are going to, as a business, send a commercial text message, you must get express consent first. And not just someone saying, yeah, I agree that people may send me text messages. You have to get people to sign up for your company's commercial text messages in advance. And you have to give them a reliable way to turn it off. That's why, if you ever have done this, you know, text this to receive a coupon or whatever, or just text this, the first thing that comes back is basically a disclaimer. Do you really want this from us? Answer yes or no. That's why, because the law requires them to get express consent. So even if our plaintiff here cannot succeed in preferring criminal charges under the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, she may still have at least a de minimis action under federal consumer protection laws and a private right of action there. It's just maybe that, and there may be other things that she's claiming here. Right? She brings a putative class action. So we don't have that here. Okay. I think it's useful, although we've gone through a lot of these things in our discussion last week, to look at the analysis of the different elements of the statutes and see some of the examples where those attempts stood or fell. So let's move on. U.S. v. Chubinsky. Why don't you help us with U.S. v. Chubinsky?
So Chubinsky...
Where are we? Brief our case for us, please.
It's the United States criminal trial.
Well, oh, it's actually not.
No.
Not anymore. Where is Chubinsky? No. From which court do we get this opinion that we find on page 492 of our book?
Well, it's an appeal.
Right. So it's not a trial. Which court is it? You can tell by the citation.
The First Circuit.
It's the First Circuit Court of Appeals. So he is appealing a conviction. We're not at the trial level. He has been convicted of violating 1030A4. And what is 1030A4 about?
Well, he's appealing his 9 counts of wire fraud and 4 counts of computer fraud in connection to, basically, he was using the integrated data retrieval system of the IRS, worked in the IRS in Boston.
Right.
He was looking at a bunch of information about the people he knew. For the IRS, so he was allowed to look at it, but not in the sense that he was looking at it.
Okay, so what are the particular elements of the offense with which he was charged? What does 1030A4 cover?
Need to have the defendant needs to knowingly and willingly participate in a scheme or artifice to fraud with the specific intent to fraud, and to use interstate wire
Well, let's look at the words of the actual statute. It's on 490. Okay, hold on. Knowingly. So there is a knowing. This is not an accidental unknowing. Okay?
With or in excess of others.
No. No.
Without.
Knowingly and. It says right there at the top of 490 after the little number 4.
With intent to defraud.
With intent to defraud. So we're already going to have to define what defraud means and that there's an intention. It's not just knowing the action of knowing. There's an intent to defraud. Yes, then what?
Without authorization.
Nope. Keep going.
Or exceeds.
Nope. What comes after intent to defraud in the comma?
A protected behavior.
Before a protected... There's a word there. There really is.
Knowingly and with intent to defraud.
Accesses. Okay? We have to have access. Access is what?
A protected
computer. A protected computer. Okay? How?
Or exceeding authority.
Okay. And does what?
By means of such conduct furthers the intended fraud.
Stop. So by means of the conduct the fraud is furthered. And
obtains anything of value.
And then it goes into this issue of computer. Of the value being the access to the computer, and as the book says, and as we discussed, hard to get to that level. Whatever the number, you know, you're not paying $5,000 a year to access most computers unless you're stealing Westlaw service. Okay, lots of elements here. Knowingly, intent, defraud, accesses, protected computer, without authorization or exceeding authorization, and furthers the fraud, and obtain something of value. Lots of elements here. Let's look at Chabinsky. Was he knowing in this? Okay. Did he intend to defraud? Let's set that one aside. Okay? So far we're yes and probably no. Did he access a computer? Was it a protected computer? Was it without authorization?
He had authorization.
Ah. Did he exceed his authorization?
Yes.
Okay, so we're so far, lots of yeses, one no. Right? Did he further the fraud by means of data access? Again, that has to go back to the fraud. Did he obtain something of value?
Yes.
Questionable.
He still got the information.
But did the information have any value? Then you have to look at how the value is defined. What? Well,
because I mean, like, clearly you didn't use blackmail.
Right. Now it could be that it was of value to him, but is that sufficient?
Well, I didn't understand.
Go ahead.
The court says that I guess he's intended to. He said at one point that he was going to build a dossier.
The word is dossier. Just letting you know. Which simply means a file. Literally means a file.
So doesn't that mean, like, couldn't you get intent to defraud from that? Maybe he didn't actually do it, but there's still an intent, maybe.
Did you know that the registrar's office has a dossier on you? Did you know that the Office of Student Services has a dossier on you?
Yeah, that I, like, made, that I left it.
That's correct. Does the existence of a dossier indicate an intent to defraud? Right. So you actually have to show an intent to defraud. So which elements here failed? We don't show an intent to defraud. And we don't show necessarily obtaining anything of value in the context of the fraud, right? It's not just... So they're actually reading them together. And as the court correctly points out, and as we have discussed, merely accessing a protected computer, even intentionally, without authorization or by exceeding authorization, is not enough. It has to be there in order for the rest of these various crimes to be proven, but that's not by itself a crime. It's a predicate. And here, like I said, every single element must be there or the conviction fails. And here, conviction failed.
So there's basically no, like, as long as you're viewing information that exceeds your authorization, there's really not really a penalty for it. As long as you got no, like, bad debt.
Well, that may be, unless you can say that you obtain information, it's not this crime. Obtaining information may be, but which section of 1030, 18 U.S.C. 1030 should he, or perhaps was he, prosecuted under properly? We go back, right? A2. A2C, information from a protected computer, or maybe some of the government ones. Did he get information? Yes, sure. So why does the government care whether he's prosecuted under A2C or here, whether he's prosecuted under A4? What's the difference? It's still 1030A, isn't it? What's the difference?
The penalty.
The penalty. It's a more severe penalty. It is a more serious crime. They want to get him on the better offense. Or the worse offense, I should say. Instead, they got him basically on the he could have got him on the lesser included offense. I remember that phrase. If they, in fact, prosecuted him that way. Did they charge the jury? I don't know. We don't have the jury instructions. But here, the prosecutor had to choose which law is going to be invoked, which offense. And the prosecutor picked one, which apparently worked on the trial level, but on appeal, it fails. Because the words of the statute, the elements of the offense, are missing. So it's here it wasn't that the wording was vague. This wasn't included and should have been. It was included as a lesser offense. But this one, this is not the conduct, says the court, with which Congress was concerned when drafting A4. And so a conviction based on A4 fails. Was he right to snoop because he had access? No. Satisfying one's curiosity? Maybe even thinking about what one could do? Ooh, what I could do with this information. It may not be what we want from our federal employees, but it may not be this particular federal crime. All right? And then it brings us to Robert Tappan Morris. And I actually have an illustration here, which I think may help, because what happened, we don't really have a lot with Morris to explain. Hold on. Where's my sign? No. Thank you. Go find it, dog. Go. Find it. There it is. We can go with this. Is this going to get us there? I have a fun little... Is this where my illustration is? There it is. Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is an important case. It is an early case. Notice it's 1991. Basically, this is... setting aside the nice little heading, the classic example of a hacker causing damage. That, folks, is a value judgment by the author and may not be that judgment of someone else. Let me tell you about Robert Tappan Morris. Junior. Because it's important to understand the facts of this case. And they are not particularly clear unless you've gone into it a little bit more. Understand we're talking about quite a number of years ago, 1988, 25 years ago, when the internet was very small. It was basically academic and some business and government. It was still against the authorized use rules of the internet to use it for commercial purposes. That's how far, that was 1991 when that changed. So Morris was a grad student. Brilliant computer science grad student. His father had been one of the people who had created, I think, the Unix programming language. Major guy. So Morris is in Cornell. And he creates a program that will, well, as he describes it, and I'm not, you know, his description was he wanted to illustrate. All right, maybe I'll go with this description. He was either a malicious hacker or a non-malicious hacker. So if that's what our author means, maybe I can be okay with this. Did he cause damage? Yes. According to Morris, he noted that there was a bug in the standard software that all these interconnected computers use to send and receive email from each other. You see the word daemon. This is a little confusing. It is not a little pointed, you know, a little guy with pointed with horns and a little pointed tail and a pitchfork. A daemon in this context is a small program. Why it was called that, I don't know. I'm sure there's a historical reason. A small program that was running in the operating system of all these computers. And it was, this particular one was send mail, because that's what it was designed to do. But he noticed there was a bug in it, and he wanted to prove, according to him, that there was a security issue, that things that should not be transmittable could be transmitted. And so he created this worm program designed to burrow through. That's why they call it a worm. And what he said was supposed to happen was he created this program and transmitted it and made a copy of it and transmitted it to another computer. What was supposed to happen then was it was supposed to check, do I already exist on this other computer? Is there a copy of me here? No. Okay, then I will make a copy of myself, leave it here, and transmit myself to yet another computer. And then the idea was he would then go to the systems administrators and say, is your computer secure? And they would say, yes, of course it is. And he would say, oh, really? Well, did you know that I snuck my daemon program, my worm program, onto your computer through the send mail because there's a hole in the security? They say, haha, no, you didn't. He'd say, really? Check what's running on your computer. Oh my gosh, you did. You've taught us something. That's the theory. Except, there was a bug in the software. All right, so this is what was supposed to happen. Eventually, one copy on every computer. Except, the programs weren't so good at determining whether or not there was a copy already running. And there was a bug. And what happened instead was that lots and lots of copies ended up on all of the computers. And this is 25 years ago, computers not particularly powerful, not particularly filled with memory, and every program they were running took them away from doing something else. And so, in short order, the only thing that the entire internet was capable of doing was running these programs. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of copies. Nothing else getting done. He broke the internet. He did. He broke the internet. And they had to shut everything down, wipe it and go back to backups, like they did on Galactica when the Cylon virus went in. I was just watching this episode a few days ago. Right? The Cylons had a virus. It did this, although it was definitely malicious because they were robots and the little things went back and forth. So, this is the fact. He broke the internet. Whatever his, and the question of his intentions are really important here. Did he intend to break the internet or not? The version of 10A5 under which he was convicted at the time, right? Intentionally accesses a federal interest computer without authorization and, by means of one or more instances of such conduct, alters, damages, or destroys information in any federal interest computer, or prevents authorized use of any such computer or information, and thereby causes loss to one or more others of a value aggregating $1,000 or more during any 1 year period. So what's his defense? Did he do this? Yes. Did he break the internet? Yes. Did he cost a lot of money in support costs? Yeah. No question. He wrote the program. He sent the program. The program multiplied. It shut everything down. They had to fix it. What's the defense? So what? What if he didn't mean it? Why is that? Why was that relevant? You're correct. Why was that relevant?
Because that shows that he didn't intend to do it.
And what was his argument regarding the wording of the statute that we have here on the top of 500 with regard to what was required for liability? What are our elements of the crime as it existed then? Intentional, right? Access. Federal interest computer, what we'd now call a protected computer, but yeah, we're okay with that. Without authorization, by means of that, altering, damaging, or destroying information, or preventing authorized use, and thereby causing loss. So which did he argue wasn't true?
Unauthorized
access. That was one argument. So, but the suggestion here was, what we have here is actually not about the unauthorized access part. Yes, that was another part of the case, and whether he exceeded his authorization, that's, you notice now, it no longer just says without authorization. Notice the statutes now talk about exceeding authorization. Here's why. Because there was that gray area. Did he have the right to log in at Cornell? Sure. Did he have the right to log in at Harvard and MIT? To do this? Maybe not so much. That's where you get the gray area. But what do we have here? What's the particular argument he's making on 500? It's not about the unauthorized access part. Which element is he questioning?
Intent.
Intent. What was? What does he say the intent refers to? I see your hands.
Yeah, no.
No, I'm saying.
Intent is part of his access to it.
Right. He says, but that's not what his argument is. He's saying, in order to prove this, you have to show I intentionally caused harm. I intentionally caused loss. Right? He says, that's the way this, that's what this means. And since I did intend to access, but I'm arguing didn't intend to cause damage, I should not be liable. What does the government say? What does the government say the intentional part refers to? What does the government say? Does the government argue that the intention was with regard to the damage or loss?
Yes.
No. It doesn't. The government says the only thing that the intentional part refers to is the access. the damage or loss could be unintentional, could be accidental. We still have liability here. The court reads, based on legislative history and some and principles of statutory construction, right? The court reads, the intentionally standard applies only to the accesses part phrase of section 1030A5A and not to its damages phrase. The court rejects Morris's argument, says, we will not read the statute the way you want us to read it, Mr. Morris. We will not read into the statute that you had to intend to cause damage or loss. All we're going to require for you to have liability under this version of the statute is you intended to access without authorization. And since the jury could legitimately find that, that's enough. Was there damage? Yes. Did it rise above this monetary list? Yes. We've established that. The facts show that. And your defense, your appeal that they should have read this as you had to intend to cause that damage, no. So whether or not you can convincingly tell us you didn't intend the damage, doesn't matter. You intended the access. That's all the statute requires. You are now liable. Remember, folks, this is not what it says today. If you go to 1030, section 18 U.S.C. 1030, you will not find these words. So you don't look to the Morris case as precedent for interpreting the statute. What you want to read this as, is the method. How do the courts take the statute as was, now remember, as was the case when the incident occurred? Was it illegal at the time? The statute may have been amended since then. But here, right? So the court looked at it, looked at the words, looked at the statutory language, at the statutory history, legislative history, and said, the language we have here, when we apply it to your facts and circumstances, the elements are all satisfied. You can be held liable. He was. Whether or not he intended this to happen. In the end, it didn't matter for the purposes of the conviction. He didn't need to intend the damage. It just did. We see in today's version of the statute that we have two very similar, right? We have two very similar offenses that we looked at last week. Where's our full screen? No. Hold on. If you look at 5B and 5C, intentionally accesses a protected computer without authorization and as a result of such conduct recklessly causes damage, or intentionally accesses a protected computer without authorization and as a result of such conduct causes damage and loss. In the former, in 1030A5B, you've got to demonstrate recklessness. Disregard for the consequences. In A5C, you don't. You have to show that there was loss, as defined, not just damage. So whether you can show one or the other, that's going to determine where you might successfully be able to bring a prosecution, or if you're defending, whether you might challenge the prosecution because they chose one whose elements are not in fact met. Some more words that we have to look at. International Airport Centers versus Jacob Citrin. Anyone want to take a shot at that one? What's the word that we're concerned about right there? Hmm? So, which word?
Transmission.
Oh, wait. Transmission. That's the word. So what are the facts? Okay, since you've gotten us started, where is this court? Where is this case? It's not a district court. Page 501. What court is this being heard in?
Seventh Circuit.
Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Right? And it's an appeal from the plaintiff's suit for failure to state a claim. So the plaintiffs, this was a civil, right? Or at least the plaintiffs were trying to bring a lawsuit under this statute. It was dismissed and they appealed the dismissal. And so the plaintiff is trying to demonstrate what? So what happened here? Who was Citrin? What did he do?
I guess he was, Citrin is the defendant.
He is.
Because he was in real estate business. And
he worked for the plaintiff, in fact, didn't he?
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened when he stopped working for the plaintiff?
Well, he went into the business for himself.
Yes, he did, but that's not the claim here. This isn't an unfair competition claim. What did he do that generates a computer fraud claim?
Well, he breached his employer contract by going into business by himself.
That's not what this is about. Why are we talking about this in cybercrime? What did he do?
Deleted on the
day. He deleted, and what did he delete? He didn't just delete his files. He deleted the files that showed that he was doing bad stuff before. Okay? And he really deleted them. This wasn't just hitting delete. He got a secure erase program. He made them go away. So what is it that IAC, his former employer, sought to have him charged with? What were the elements of the offense?
I guess when he deleted them, they didn't have any more copies.
Well, it was evidence issues, right? Right, they had no other copies. So what were the elements of the offense with which he was charged? Under which statute is he charged? 18 U.S.C. 1030 what? 5A1. Exactly. And what is 5A1? As it's here and here it's 5A, right? Knowingly causes the transmission of a program, information, code, or command, and as a result of such conduct, intentionally causes damage without authorization to a protected computer. And here they're saying the computer is protected. So what's the question? What element of that offense? Did he intentionally cause damage to the computer without authorization?
Well, I guess he's saying that merely erasing.
Let's sort of back out here. According to this, protected computer, check. So that there's federal jurisdiction. Did he intentionally cause damage?
Yes.
Did he have authorization to cause that damage?
Yeah.
No, he didn't.
He didn't have authorization.
Okay, so we're good. So to the end of it. Was there a program, information, code, or command that caused the intentional damage? Sure there was. It was it was delete command. Did he do it knowingly?
Yes.
Which leaves us with what?
Transmission,
a very important verb. It doesn't say knowingly runs a program. It says transmits a program. And what do you think, and what does the court think, that statute was really focusing on?
Well,
What kind of activity was this about? Transmitting information program code or command to intentionally cause damage without authorization. What kind of activities are they talking about, do you think? What situations do you think might fall under that?
Copying files or moving them.
Well, that might not be damage. Deleting, maybe. Remotely deleting something. Emailing a virus. All those sorts of things. Except there's a problem here. Did he transmit? Right? Did he broadcast or send somewhere? No. Or at least that's the question. He didn't erase it remotely. It didn't, right? This isn't about access. This is about the transmission part. The fact that it's a different statute, it's a different set of language, suggests that it's a different activity. But here, the court isn't necessarily, because we don't know. Anybody look up this case to see what exactly ended up being the result? Because we get the beginning of the discussion, right? Ultimately, the court finds that there is transmission. But even if it doesn't, it finds that he violated 1030A5A2. He accessed it. So you have to really look at the issue of transmission. And so you can imagine arguing one way or the other on this. And the court focuses on that word because all the other elements are there. That's how important it is that you get every single element. Right? So what about Carlson? What did he do? He spammed. He spammed a lot. Not only did he spam, he faked the sending address. And what happened to the people whose addresses he used without permission? Has this ever happened? It happened to my wife a few months ago. They thought her computer had been hacked into. It didn't seem that it actually had. But it was so... It's called Joe-jobbing. That's the spammer, the anti-spammer phrase for this. Where you basically insert a real, but not the actual sender's address into the message. What happens when multiple emails are sent out, many to incorrect addresses? They get bounced back. And we first knew it was happening, and that seems to be the case, because my wife's inbox started filling with, you know, rejected emails, systems, you know, incorrect address or whatever. Right? So we're looking at the statute here. Knowingly caused the transmission of a program, information, code, or command, and as a result of such conduct, intentionally caused damage without authorization to a protected computer. And he knew that the inbox, a targeted person's, that is, so there are two victims here. In one case, he blasted a whole bunch of emails to one person, filling that person's inbox. And the other, he spoofed the address so that the person whose address got all those returns. And here the court finds that he intended the resultant damage. Knowingly caused the transmission, intended to cause the damage. Element satisfied. And in Middleton, He created somebody else's account. He went in, had used his access, got into somebody else's account. And from there, was messing with the billing system. So what was the damage he caused? Was it just the deletion of the databases, which he did do? What else was the damage?
Came into the person to fix an Arthropod situation, which were way above the allotted time of $5,000. All the hours accrued towards the end.
Yep. So, there are questions here of the damage, and that because this person who fixed it was salaried, the argument is there's no additional damage. They were paying him anyway. The court disagrees with that. And so, here, the intention is shown. This here was the question of damage or loss. And the jury was reasonably able to determine damage or loss. Okay. I don't have the syllabus in front of me, but keep going as is. As if it were, we're basically back a week. So whatever assignment we should have done for this assignment should have been for last week. Next week's assignment should be what we should have read for this week, but we lost a class. If you haven't seen the new syllabus, it's on Westlaw. Essentially, what I've done is taken the second to last class and the last class and combined them. Because it was all sort of time for review and to be determined and stuff. All right? Have a good day.